Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm going to be talking about the Hamiltonian description of the conservative piece of the self force, and also a non-perturbative approach to self force that we developed with my advisor, Aina Flanagan, and in collaboration with Abraham Hart. So first I'm going to give an introduction about gravitational waves and why do we need to understand these systems. Then I'm going to be talking about Hamiltonian systems, just a quick recap of how that works. Then I'm going to explain very quickly the self force and why do we need that. And then I'm going to go into the main results, which are the first and second order Hamiltonian description of the self force. And then a non-perturbative approach for the self force that fixes some subtleties that arise at the second order. And I think I do have time for the talk, so if anyone has questions and wants to stop me, you can just raise your hand and I will try to answer questions as I go, if that's okay. So we are going to be talking about binary systems, as the introduction said. These are compact objects with masses between 10 and 10 to the 6 solar masses. These are highly eccentric. They can have different masses, different spins. And these are the primary sources of gravitational waves. We have measured these waves in LIGO. Now, the frequency sensitivity at LIGO goes between 10 hertz and 10 to the 4 hertz. And because the frequency is inversely proportional to the mass of the system, we detect comparable mass in spirals of neutron stars or black holes between one solar mass and 10 solar masses. And these signals typically last seconds. In the near future, hopefully, we will have LISA, which is a space-based detector, which has a much lower frequency sensitivity range because most of the low-frequency noise comes from the Earth. So if you're in space, that's okay. And because the frequency sensitivity is lower, the typical sources are going to be much, much more massive, which leaves us with two options. We can have comparable mass in spirals of supermassive black holes, or extreme mass ratio in spirals, where there's a stellar mass object in spiraling into a supermassive black hole. And these signals are going to last much longer, as opposed to the LIGO signals. And LISA started building, I think, last month or something, so it's working, I think, I hope. So let me talk a bit about extreme mass ratio in spirals. There's two scales in the system. One is the orbital time scale, so the time it takes to go around once. And the other one is the radiation reaction time scale, that scales like the mass of the primary squared over the mass of the secondary. Intuitively, this means that if you take the point particle limit, or geodesic motion, then the system doesn't radiate, and it just stays circling forever, which makes sense. But this means that the system is going to go through many, many cycles before merging, which gives us an unparalleled probe of strong gravity, which is the name of this seminar, so it's fitting. And because these orbits are really eccentric and they get really close to the strong gravity region for many, many cycles. So if we understand EMRIs and we can model them, we can learn a lot about gravity. But because this is the signals are going to be longer and there's a different time scales, we do need to be very accurate to understand this. Now, like I said, we can understand binary systems in different regimes. If the distance is really big, people use Newtonian theory, post-Newtonian theory, sorry. If most scales are similar, like similar mass, like there's not too much complicated stuff going on, then people can use numerical relativity. And when the mass ratio is really big, we need to use perturbation theory, or what is known as the self force. And in that regime, numerical relativity doesn't work because you have two different timescales, like I said. And post-Newtonian expansions also break down because of the eccentricity and how close the secondary can get to the primary. The self force models EMRIs, like I said. It also models intermediate mass ratio in spirals. That has been shown recently. And it's also useful for cross-checks with other approximations, because if you're expanding in the mass ratio, you still have all orders in the distance, and vice versa. So then you can do double expansions and compare order by order and get more information. So I'm also going to be talking about the conservative and dissipative split of the dynamics. There's a question mark there because it's not always clear how to do that. But when we do know how to do it, the dissipative piece drives the in spiral of the binary system, and the conservative piece modifies orbital features such as the innermost stable circular orbit, periastronaut bands, and things like that. And this is useful because usually we only need one piece of the dynamics to get results. But also, once we have a conservative sector, we can find a Hamiltonian, which greatly simplifies calculations. And also, because once we have a Hamiltonian, we can ask questions about integrability, which also greatly simplifies calculations. So now, let me give a quick recap on Hamiltonian mechanics, just so we are all on the same page. We have a phase-space coordinate that I'm going to call Q, that is position and momentum. We have a non-degenerate symplectic form. That's the form it takes in canonical coordinates, but it can be anything, really. And then we have a Hamiltonian function that determines the flow on phase space. Equation 3 here is just Hamilton's equations written in a more geometric, abstract way, but it's just Hamilton's equations. One more thing, equation 3 here can be derived from an action principle as well, which is going to be important later. And once you have a Hamiltonian system, you can also ask if it's integrable. For a system to be integrable, you need n conserved quantities that all commute with each other. And if you have that, then you can fully solve the problem using action angle variables, which is amazing. And that's why we want to know if things are integrable or not. Now, we can also perturb a Hamiltonian system with some random vector in phase space. And then this is no longer Hamiltonian. But then we can ask the question, okay, when can this be recasted as a Hamiltonian system? And the answer is, if you can reabsorb this perturbation into a new symplectic form and a new Hamiltonian, then you're done. This has been recasted as a Hamiltonian system. This type of thing has been done in different approximation schemes. Here I have in the first column the name of the method, in the second column, what are you expanding on? Third column is the zeroth order of the method, and the last column is some references that give the Hamiltonian description of the conservative piece of the dynamics. In particular, my advisor and I worked on the small mass ratio expansion and found the Hamiltonian to linear order in the mass ratio, and later we included this linear and spin effects. And those are.
Conservative,
or specifically part of the
position is not easy to identify, so in this case it is.
Yes, at the linear order, we do know how to split the dynamics.
Leading order.
Yes, to leading order in the mass ratio, it is known. That's a good question, yes. To leading order in the mass ratio, it is known how to separate the dynamics. And then some of the subtleties that arise at second order have to do with not knowing what is the conservative piece. So yes, but at first order, we know how to do it, and I'm going to talk about that in a bit. So the zeroth order piece of the small mass ratio expansion is geodesic motion, which looks like this. It's a mess, but it's Hamiltonian, and it's also integrable because there's three conserved quantities, energy, angular momentum, and Cantor constant, and it's integrable. So then we can ask, okay, we have a system that is Hamiltonian and integrable when the secondary is a test particle. It moves in a geodesic. What happens when we perturb this with the self force? So now let me explain what the self force is. The idea is that we have a primary object that sources the background metric, which is the big thing here in the middle, and the secondary, which is the tiny one here, is moving on an effective metric, which is G0 plus H. H is the perturbation sourced by the secondary itself. And the idea is that geodesic motion in the effective metric G tilde is equivalent to forced motion with respect to the background metric. What I mean is the following. You can start with geodesic motion respect to G tilde, and then take all terms proportional to H and move them to the right-hand side, and then you get forced motion respect to the background metric. And this F, which is proportional to H, is the self force. So the cell force is the interaction of the secondary with its own metric perturbation. And in that sense, it's similar to the Lennard-Wittrod potential, where you have a particle radiating because it interacts with its own field. So the cell force schematically looks like this. Looks like the gradient of the integral of a two-point function that is being sourced by the world line of the particle, but the full history of the world line of the particle. And the gradient here only acts on Z and not on this gamma. And one way to understand this is that the object can emit gravitational waves at any point, and then these can backscatter of the curvature, because we are in a Kerr spacetime, and then they can be reabsorbed at a later time. So we do need to integrate over the full past history of the particle. Raise your hand. That's a great question. It depends on which piece of the cell force do you want. If you want the full physical cell force, it's a retarded Green's function. If you want the conservative dynamics, you pick a different Green's function. And it depends on which piece of the cell force you want. I'm going to talk about that in the next slide. Thank you. So to leading order, we do know how to make the split. And it's exactly that question. It's depending on which Green's function you pick, you get different dynamics. So you can pick the retarded or advanced Green's functions. But then you can pick the conservative Green's function, which is retarded plus advanced, or the dissipative Green's function, which is retarded minus advanced. And these have two important properties. They're respectively symmetric and anti-symmetric under exchange of arguments, and even or odd under time reversal. And usually in the literature, people just call these time symmetric and time anti-symmetric, because these two properties happen at the same time. But at second order, there is the possibility of things being even but anti-symmetric, or symmetric but odd. So both properties are going to be important. So to answer the question in this context, the full physical cell force is given by the retarded Green's function, and then you can separate the dynamics in this way as conservative plus dissipative. And here is a summary of everything that can happen on the cell force, if anyone wanted to know. So on the first column, I have the name of the effect. Second column is how it enters the energy, what's the energy scaling of the effect. Third column is the phase shift that this effect induces on a waveform after one Fullian spiral. And the last column is some references that point to the Hamiltonian description of this effect. And I think I can't decide between m and mu. Sorry, small m is the secondary, big M is the primary, and epsilon is the mass ratio. So we have first order dissipative and conservative cell forces, which both scale like the mass ratio. But the dissipative effects are 1 over epsilon more important than the conservative effects. And that's because dissipative effects tend to accumulate over orbits, while conservative effects tend to average out after each orbit. So because the number of cycles is 1 over epsilon, there's a cumulative effect that makes dissipative things 1 over epsilon stronger than conservative effects. And then we have the second order, dissipative and conservative effects, same thing. Then we have the leading spin curvature coupling, which is actually not a self-force effect. It's just the coupling of the spin of the secondary with the multiples of the spacetime. And it's what happens with satellites around the Earth. It's a very known effect that we know how to describe with Hamiltonian mechanics. And then in the last two lines, we have the spin-induced self-force. And the way to understand this is that, OK, the cell force is the interaction of the secondary with its own metric perturbation. But if the secondary has spin, spin enters the stress energy tensor, and that sources more gravity. So there's a piece of the cell force that is going to be sourced by spin. And that is the new effect that we also included in the Hamiltonian description with my advisor last year.
So question in this nomenclature, like, speaking, you said 1 over epsilon, like in first order, that the dissipative is 1 over epsilon relative to 1, the conservative.
Yes.
A similar thing is happening between 1 and epsilon. I'm just trying to think of the counting and how I'm supposed to see them as far as the impact at the end of the day.
Yeah, so when you do waveforms for Lisa, for example, you want the error in your calculation to be order epsilon. And that's why you need this up to the second order dissipative cell force is what you need. And the second order conservative cell force actually is order epsilon. So technically you don't need it for waveforms. And a similar thing happens here. Spin-induced effects are kind of second order in that way because the first order dissipative scales like the second order dissipative here. So yes, for LISA templates, you need to have accuracy of order one. So you can drop anything that is order epsilon. Okay, so now let's move on to finding the Hamiltonian for the conservative piece of the dynamics. The simplest example of a perturbation that is Hamiltonian is just when it's the gradient of a potential. It's a bit trivial. Then you just add the potential to the Hamiltonian. So the question is the cell force of this form? Here the gradient acts on the first entry, but not the second one, like I said. So this looks like the gradient of a potential, but it's the gradient of a potential that is also a functional of the full trajectory. So it's not a Hamiltonian, really. It looks like that, but it's really not. It has a tail term. And this is a cell force, but this also happens in post-Newtonian expansions. At 4 p.m., you get tail terms in the description of the interaction. So let me recast this in another way that is going to be more useful. I said that unperturbed motion can be derived from an action principle, and the first order cell force can be derived from a non-local action principle, where we add this weird thing, which is two integrals of a two-point function. When you vary respect to z, there's two instances of z here on the right-hand side, so that cancels a factor of 1/2, and then you recover the first order cell force. However, because you have two integrals, this is picking the symmetric piece of the Green's function. So you can recast the cell force as coming from a non-local action principle, but it automatically picks conservative dynamics. So now let me give one of the main results that we found. If you have any non-local Hamiltonian system with phase space coordinate Q of this form, where you have some zeroth order action principle that comes from a local Hamiltonian, and then any number of endpoint functions integrated n times, so any number of non-localities that you wish, the system can be recast as a local Hamiltonian system. And the only price to pay is that you also need to modify the symplectic form. But the Hamiltonian and the symplectic form here in equation 14 are exactly local functions on phase space. And this way of expressing the non-localities applies to the gravitational cell force, electromagnetic cell force, scalar cell force, to post-Newtonian expansions. It's a very general result. Let me give you a sketch of how the proof works. So the cell force looks like this, like I said. It's the derivative of this two-point function, where the derivative acts on the first entry, which is the local part, and the second part is a functional dependence. So the first step is to realize that if you're working to linear order, you can replace the functional dependence by the zeroth order solution. This Q0 is whatever solution for the zeroth order Hamiltonian you find with initial condition Q. So then you can rewrite the cell force in this way, where I added a superscript 1 to the derivative to show that it's only acting on the first Q but not the second one. So now the cell force is local, and that's fine. So we can say, okay, let's define a Hamiltonian that looks like this. But the problem is that if you try to derive this Hamiltonian, the derivative is going to hit the first Q, which is fine, that's the cell force, but then it's going to hit the second Q, which is not fine. So then the last step is to add a correction to a symplectic form that exactly cancels that extra derivative. And this procedure can be done to any order in the epsilons, and very generally for any endpoint function. So it applies to cell force and post-Newtonian and other approximations as well. And once you do that, it's not too complicated to do one more step, which is to find new coordinates where the symplectic form becomes canonical. And then this is the result to leading order, so to first order in the epsilons. The symplectic form, the new coordinates, is just canonical. And the only difference is that all the functional dependence is now evaluated at a solution to the previous order, so a solution of the dynamics of H0, and there's a factor of 1/2 in front. That's the only difference. OK, so with this, we can immediately take the first order self-force and put it in Hamiltonian form, and we are done.
Sorry, so in which sense is it local? I mean, you still have an iteration over class.
It's local because this depends on Q, and Q enters here locally. This thing is a function. It's supposed that you already figured out and it's some function. So you can use this Hamiltonian with all the machinery of Hamiltonian mechanics. Of course, it still has there's a tail term in the sense that you're integrating over the past, but the function is now local as opposed to a functional on phase space. So that allows you to use all the machinery of classical mechanics, which was not available before because the Hamiltonian was a functional on phase space. And one of the things you can do is ask questions about integrability now that the Hamiltonian is really a local function in phase space. Zach Nasipak, who is now a postdoc in Southampton, I think, showed that the conservative scalar self-force breaks integrability. The scalar self-force would be what happens when the secondary has a scalar field and it interacts with its own scalar field as opposed to with its own metric perturbation. And with our formalism, we know the conditions that would have to be satisfied to keep integrability. And they have to do with the CAM theorem, which is the Fourier components of the perturbation to the Hamiltonian on resonant orbits should vanish. And we know how to write that down, but we would need numerical analysis to actually check explicitly if that's satisfied or not. And it's also straightforward to add spin to this problem. If we add the spin of the secondary, it modifies the zeroth order dynamics as well as the endpoint functions, but the form of the problem is the same, so we also find a Hamiltonian description and integrability conditions in the spinning case. Well, if you're in Kerr spacetime, it has spin just because of the...
Yeah, okay. Well, I was wondering if this one was, what if you were to entertain the extremely...
It works very generally for any spacetime. I don't think there's too many conditions on the background metric. It can be Kerr or it can be extremal.
Well, I'm thinking about the aerodynamic stability, which maybe radial stability, but yeah, something.
No, I think you can do this on extremal black holes.
Right, but at some point, I should see the remnants of
When you say instability, you mean?
Yeah, so linear perturbations blow up at the horizon.
Yeah, I see, yes.
But
I would have to think about that, yes. I'm not sure. Yeah, I would have to think about that.
Like, can you just say a little bit more about what exactly the calculation is
that you perform? Yes. So you select the correct Green's function to care only about conservative dynamics. So you have the time symmetric Green's function. And then you calculate the average rate of change of the Carter constant. Because you're doing conservative dynamics, and because energy and angular momentum have fluxes associated with them, they don't change. The average rate of change of energy and angular momentum when you have conservative cell force is zero. The Carter constant evolves with time during resonances. It's zero generally, but when the secondary enters a resonance, the even the conservative piece of the cell force drives the Carter constant away. And that's, I guess, like a smoking gun of integrability. You can check that that is equivalent of the breakdown of integrability. But the calculation explicitly is that, calculating the rate of change of the Carter constant during resonant orbits.
And so we're imagining that you would just calculate for some example or orbits going to resonance and then find yes or no, or you can have the check for
them. I guess if you, as long as on some resonant orbit it breaks down, that's it. You only need to break down for one resonant orbit, and that's it. I don't know if that was the question.
Yeah, well, for the scalar force, is it kind of like generic orbits going through resonance break integrability, or something special?
I think he checked it for a couple of specific resonant orbits, because he did numerical work. And it's also the low order resonances, like the 2, 3, or 1, 2, or some low ratio resonance. Yes.
And is there a heuristic that you could say about whether you think for the gravitational case it would be less or more likely?
People have teamed up on both sides of that. Some people say, well, if the scalar breaks down, of course gravity breaks down because it's more complicated. And the other team says, well, no, gravity is kind of like a gauge theory. It has a lot of extra symmetry, so of course it's integrable. And we don't know. So someone should check. If anyone here wants to check, please do it. It would be great.
It's just a very naive question. Way more naive than I think the conversation's about this. So the dispositive terms cannot be incorporated into Hamiltonian formation, right?
Well, if the Hamiltonian depends explicitly on time, you can have a Hamiltonian that includes dissipation.
You had a table before with a lot of X's in it, right? So different order, different dissipative terms broke Hamiltonian configuration.
Yeah, so we don't know how to find a Hamiltonian for the dissipative pieces, because the proof that I showed earlier does require that your Hamiltonian is still time independent. But I suppose that you could find a Hamiltonian that includes dissipation. And going one step back to answer that question a bit more precisely, I mentioned that this action principle picks the symmetric piece of the endpoint function, so it automatically picks conservative dynamics for you. So it would be a bit hard. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine how would you write down an action principle that includes dissipation,
right,
in this sense. And I have two more answers that maybe help you a bit more. One way to derive this is to start with an action that has the field and the particle, and then integrate out the field. And then you get these tail terms. When you do that, you get this plus boundary conditions, some boundary terms that you then throw. The dissipation is in the boundary terms that you're throwing, and then you get an action principle that gives you conservative dynamics.
Okay.
And one last thing to say, if you did want to have an action principle that includes dissipation, let's go to like this one, for example, it's not hard to do it. You just pick one of these Zs, and you make it an independent external world line. And you don't vary in respect to that. It's a new degree of freedom. And you take the factor of 1/2, I guess, because now it's not symmetric anymore. And then after you are done with the calculations, you set that external thing equal to your degrees of freedom. And then you get the full cell force. But the price to pay is that you have double degrees of freedom in the action now. And you have to do this weird trick where you assume that it's not the position of the particle, and then after you take derivatives, you say, no, it actually is, and you set that coincidence in the end. And with that, you can include dissipation as well. Where was I? I guess somewhere here. Thank you for the questions. These were really good questions. Okay, let me go back to the autopilot where I was. Okay. So this concludes the first order derivation of the Hamiltonian. So now let's go to second order Hamiltonian. If the first order self-force was the gradient of a two-point function, the second order self-force should look like the gradient of a three-point function. And if this were the case, we are done. We can just immediately apply the proof that I showed earlier. This equation 21 comes from an action principle that is non-local, and we are done. So now let me tell you why that doesn't work and all the subtleties that arise. The first problem is that we don't even know what the conservative piece is. At first order, it is simply retarded plus advanced. But Einstein's equations are non-linear. So at second order, we will have products of retarded Green's functions in this G3 in equation 21 that will come from solving the second order metric perturbation that is sourced by the first order metric perturbation. So it's going to have a bunch of retarded Green's functions. And that is going to give us a bunch of weird combinations of conservative and dissipative. And then the question is, what is the prescription for picking conservative dynamics here? If you think that it has to be time even, well, dissipative times conservative is time even. So are you going to pick that or not? And if you say, no, actually it has to be symmetric and the exchange of arguments, well, then it turns out that dissipative times dissipative times dissipative is also symmetric and the exchange of arguments. So are you going to pick that? That doesn't even have any conservative stuff in it. So we have a tentative solution, which is to go back to the first order Green's function and realize that it satisfies both properties. So we need to pick the piece that is both symmetric under the exchange of arguments and time even. And the symmetry under exchange of arguments is also motivated because our proof starts from an action principle that picks the symmetric piece. And the time even part is motivated because conservative dynamics should be time even. Another problem is that if you get all these combinations of terms at second order, it means that your conservative metric perturbation or your conservative piece of the field in general stops being a solution of the field equations. Because your field at first order is going to be sourced by GC, but at second order, it's going to be sourced by things that maybe have some dissipative contributions in it. So it's being sourced by a first order piece of the field that is not there because you're picking the conservative dynamics. But if you pick symmetric and time even, we can show that you get something that is proportional to conservative Green's functions to all orders. So it's still a solution to the field equations.
So that sounds very reasonable and perhaps intuitive. But if you wanted to check,
yes,
make this into a theorem,
There's one option is to go to a specific example and explicitly calculate this three-point function and then project the symmetric piece, which is what you need for our proof. That is a bit implicit. It's not really a theorem. If you want a theorem, you should start with the full retarded solution, put it into the equations of motion, and somehow check which piece of the endpoint functions is responsible for driving the evolution of conserved quantities. You should do some expansion over action angle variables and check which ones are driving which thing. Which is an interesting thing that I was thinking about after I'm done with all this in the near future. So it would be nice to check it explicitly. So another problem is infrared divergences. That, spoilers, we do not know how to fix this one. This is still a problem. The idea is that the retarded Green's function makes the system radiate to future infinity. If you pick the advanced Green's function, the system is receiving radiation from minus infinity. But then when you pick the conservative Green's function, you have standing waves all the way to spatial infinity. You have stuff coming in, stuff going out. You're adding them up because the conservative Green's function is retarded plus advanced. So you have standing waves all the way to spatial infinity. And this is OK at first order. But first order waves are sources for the second order perturbations. So you have divergent energy at infinity. And we don't really know how to fix this now. So for now, everything I said at second order only applies to unbound orbits, where the two objects come, interact for a bit, and then go their separate ways, because then the radiation only happens for a finite window of time, and you don't get this buildup of infinite energy. I think Alan Pound is working on this in Southampton with one of his students. And the idea was to start with unbound and then analytically continue to bound and find a regularization scheme in that way. But that's all I'm going to say about that before saying something wrong. And one last problem is that we don't even know what the three-point function is supposed to be. The current methods for calculating the second-order cell force don't give a simple closed expression for the three-point function in the cell force. So let me be very clear. We do have methods for calculating the second-order cell force. But because the cell force is the interaction of the secondary with its own metric perturbation, and because that has a Coulomb-like piece that diverges at the position of the particle, second-order cell force is super divergent, and you need to do a bunch of regularization schemes to fix it and to extract a finite cell force. And after all the intermediate steps, it's not clear at all that the cell force is just a gradient of a three-point function. So to fix this last problem, we worked with Abraham Hart on a new formalism to calculate second-order cell force that ended up being like killing a mosquito with a bazooka, because we just wanted to extract something for the Hamiltonian and ended up finding a non-perturbative approach to cell force at any order, dissipative and conservative. So far, it only applies to scalar cell force. It doesn't have point particle divergences to deal with. Everything is finite. It gives simple expressions for the cell force at any order. Salud. In terms of endpoint functions, and the fully symmetric piece of the endpoint functions is given by conservative Green's functions at all orders. But it still has infrared divergences. That is still a problem. So now, if I have time, how am I doing with time? OK.
We still have 18 minutes.
OK, good. So I'm going to just give you a quick overview of how this looks. We start with a toy model that has a scalar field, phi, coupled to matter. So this rho is an extended scalar charge density. We have some matter Lagrangian that can be anything you like dust or a fluid or whatever. The usual term for the scalar field, a potential that is a nonlinear self-interaction, and the interaction between rho and phi. If you calculate the equations of motion, you get the usual equations. And importantly, the evolution of the stress energy tensor for matter is being forced by the gradient of the scalar field. And this has many of the properties that we want for the gravitational cell force. First, phi is nonlinear because we added the potential. So that's like gravity, and it's being sourced by rho. But also, as rho moves through curved spacetime, it will experience a self force that is rho times the gradient of phi, because phi is being sourced by rho itself. And because of this, phi is going to have a bunch of divergences on the point particle limit. Once you take rho to become a point, a delta function, phi is going to itself have a Coulomb piece that diverges at the position of the particle. So the idea that we have is, okay, let's keep everything extended. This is an extended object, so everything is finite. Let's find a field redefinition, a change of coordinates, that takes phi to a phi hat that gives the same cell force, but is a vacuum solution. So the idea is, let's take the physical field, which at the point particle limit has a Coulomb piece that diverges, and before taking the point particle limit, write it as some new phi hat plus a phi s, s standing for singular, the singular piece of the physical field. And then we can define a new action where we just plug this field redefinition in phi to get an action in terms of phi hat. And then we need to choose phi s wisely such that we get these equations of motion. So now phi hat is a vacuum solution, and we get the same expression for the cell force, but with t hat and rho hat. So some regularized t hat and rho hat that have corrected renormalization, like counter terms for the more QFT inclined people that are added to them in terms of this phi s. And once we have that, phi hat is going to be finite. It's just a vacuum solution. So you can take the point particle limit and it doesn't care. So this might sound a bit trivial, but the hard part is to pick phi s such that we get this. That sentence is doing a lot of work. And once you do that, you're left with just expanding in powers of rho and taking the point particle limit. And you can expand this equation into second order in rho and then take the point particle limit, and you recover an equation that looks like this, which is exactly the self-force equation for a point particle with mass m and charge q interacting with some scalar field. But because this is coming from phi hat, g2 and g3 are finite. They come from a vacuum solution, so we are done. And once you have this, the proof that I showed earlier immediately applies, and you can find a Hamiltonian description. But importantly, this gives you dissipation, calls for conservative effects to any order. It's just a very general non-perturbative approach to the self-force. And I think that's it. So I'm going to just give you the takeaways and be done. So the conservative piece of the first order gravitational self-force admits a Hamiltonian, and we can also include the spin of the secondary. At first order, the self-force very likely destroys integrability. That's my opinion, I guess. But we need numerics to check. We developed a non-perturbative self-force approach that gives the self-force in terms of finite n-point functions to any order. We found a unique prescription for conservative dynamics at second order. You need to pick the fully symmetric under exchange of arguments and even under time reversal piece of the n-point functions. Once you do this, the conservative piece of the dynamics admits a Hamiltonian description, and it comes from conservative Green's functions to all orders. And we still have infimate divergences. That is not solved. And we are trying to generalize all this to the gravitational case. And I think that's it. Thank you so much. And I can take any questions.
All right, so we do have time for questions. And let me ask any of our online viewers, if anybody there wanted to ask a question. Yeah, I don't see hands shooting up, so open it up to the in-person audience. Will.
Yes.
Is this a question of whether or not the self-force is immutable at first order? Does that have a practical application for my self-force calculations?
Yes, because if the first order conservative self-force is integrable, you can, so let me back up. One way to solve the self-force is to do the adiabatic approximation, where you just take a geodesic, and then you take the, all the conserved quantities, because geodesic motion is Hamiltonian and integrable, and slowly evolve them using the fluxes and the evolution. So if the first order conservative dynamics is also integrable, you can just put that back like into the integrable piece of the motion and evolve that using the dissipative self-force. And then you would include conservative effects. So that would be great. Yes. It would allow us to do a first order version of adiabatic evolutions, I guess. Any other questions?
Maybe I'll ask a question slightly. So in this approach, thinking once you turn the weights, when you think of tidal terms arising in gravitational waves, you know, I need to go to phase Poissonian order before I see that. So everything you've done here is for particle that doesn't need to be a cone, could have been a neutral star.
Yes.
So at what point, how deep do you think you need to go before you actually see the difference between the black and a small black hole or a neutral star?
Yes, that calculation has been done in the self-force community. I don't remember exactly the order, but it's something like either fourth or fifth order in the small mass ratio, and then the quadruple moments begin to really matter. But we only need second order dynamics for Lisa. So
maybe that goes back to my.
Okay, yes, now I understand. Yes.
Because it would always show up, it only would show up trying to tell you on this object that you think has mass A and speed A.
Yes. Yes, it would break down at fifth, fourth order. It's some order higher than the Lisa required order, which is second order. Yes.
So maybe I can ask an observationally minded question. So how would Lisa empirically address this question of whether or not, like you could go about this theoretically trying to find, you know, your Hamiltonian in symplectic form. But one could imagine you could go about this observationally and just ask, do, you know, after seeing 10 or 100 events, are they integral? So first, how would that work? Like, is it a clear path to doing that? And secondly, if that would work, you know, where are you in the race?
That's a good question. About the last part of the question, I believe that there is a code to give templates of the first order cell force, perfectly fine, I guess. And for the second order cell force, not really close in the race. We have 10 years, so we're good, hopefully. But it's only for circular orbits or for something. So we don't have the tools to make second order templates so far. About how you would go around measuring this observationally, I think the most important part of this question of integrability is resonant orbits. Because if you never hit a resonant orbit, the system is integrable immediately. It's just, of course. But it's not, in order for a system to be integrable, it needs to be integrable in all phase space. So it's a bit of a lie to say, if you don't hit the resonance, it's integrable. That's not how it works. Can I go all the way back? How long does this take? Okay, that's good. I guess it was some place here. So all these phase shifts induced after one in spiral, going through a resonance gives extra corrections that scale like 1 over square root of epsilon. You can do the math, and hitting a resonance gives corrections that are actually quite big.
So just to be clear, a resonance between what? Between the orbit?
Yes. So in geodesic motion in a curved black hole, you have 3 frequencies. Like, you can fully solve the problem in action angle variables, and you end up with 3 frequencies, the radial frequency, the theta, and the phi. And those 3 frequencies, if they are not ratios of each other, mean that the geodesic is going to fully cover all phase space. If the radial frequency is 2 times the angular frequency, you're going to loop around in phase space forever instead of ergodically cover all phase space. And that is a resonance. Is when the ratio of any of the 3 frequencies is a small fraction. And when that, if the perturbation to the Hamiltonian system has a Fourier component on those frequencies that doesn't vanish on resonances, it fully destroys the integrability of the system. That's the CAM theorem. Someone, Arnold, someone. I have the Arnold book, so I remember him. There you go. So that's it. So I would say you need to take care to see what happens with the resonances. But if you get it wrong, the problem is that if you get it wrong, you're not going to make observations. You're going to miss them because resonances induce a kind of a big kick in the system. So if you didn't figure out this problem correctly, you might not detect.
And is that always true? I mean, so. We'll never see a curved black hole. There'll always be background gravitational waves from other sources, etc. Right? So I thought the CAM theorem also guaranteed that as long as
there was a continuous transition, right? You'll stay on submanifold in the phase space, and the size of that manifold depends upon how bad the chaos is, right?
Yeah.
So, well, I guess it comes back to what exactly the measurement.
I guess what you want to say is that if you model the variable with which you're searching for the signal in your data stream, it would be off at some point. Then you stop following the signal.
Okay.
Well, maybe let me add one piece of information, which is, I'm not sure how this works because I really don't work on the observational side of things. But the estimation is that every detection of every waveform, let me say it again, every gravitational wave coming from an emery that we will detect will have gone through at least one resonance in the evolution. That's the estimation given, like, typical initial data for these systems. They will go through one resonance or more. So you need to take into account the resonances. And when you have a resonance, the conservative effects drive the Carter constant away, and that changes all the parameters of the orbit. So I guess that's what you need to look for these kicks during resonances that have a definite imprint on the waveform.
Can those be calculated with sufficient accuracy numerically, or do you?
I think people calculate the kicks because of resonances. Yes, I think I.
And are they sufficiently sparse in the sense that you said the waveform won't fit, but are there like nearby waveforms that will fit anything?
I'm not sure exactly how that analysis really. Yeah, I'm sorry. I know that you go through at least one resonance, and that we do have the calculations of what's the kick induced by a resonance. Yeah.
Can you follow up the previous questions? You mentioned that if you don't have resonance, the system is internal.
Yes.
That's
a lie, basically, because integrability means integrability on all phase space. Like, if your system is integrable, it means that motion on the full phase space is integrable. So it doesn't make sense to restrict to a part of the phase space.
No, but I was trying to ask about your statement. Is your statement based on the full problem or the conservative problem?
Oh, the conservative. If you have dissipation, we don't even know how to get the Hamiltonian.
Then we care, even though there is dissipation. I mean, nature doesn't give us the luxury of conceiving.
Yeah, no, I mean, the binary systems are not integrable,
right?
Because they dissipate. So the answer is definitely 100% they are not integrable in nature, yes. But because we do know how to make this split, and if the conservative piece is integrable, you can get n conserved quantities and then make them slowly evolve with the dissipation.
Sure.
It's interesting for a practical way. Yeah. Yes.
I have a small question. Just the theoretical condition that you derive a new one not working with post-Newtonian, or this is also valid in curve?
The integrability conditions we derive in the context of the small mass ratio expansion. So there's no post-Newtonian expansion of that.
Valid also then in curve.
Yes.
Because, for example, if something valid in post-Newtonian, my understanding, the expansion of this is valid, I mean, maybe close to the boundary. Space, it's the Newtonian limit is yes, it's, of course, can be the same, but inside could be different.
Yes.
Because of this expansion, but in the close to the boundary as a Newtonian limit, you cannot say that this is very important here.
Yes, so I see. So in the post Newtonian expansion, you were explaining this to me just on lunch, I should remember. In the post-Newtonian expansion, you can prove integrability of the local pieces of the Hamiltonian to any order, I guess, to 4pn or whatever you want.
Yeah, you can always show that there are for non-spanning or for spanning, you can always show that there are four conservative quantities that are mutually
commuting. Yeah.
So that then, in which sense are you saying that it doesn't work for post-Newtonian, or?
Not really. It's just, if I have some expanded symmetry, for example, that the Newtonian limit of this, it's very, I cannot say that this expanded symmetry is made also in Kerr, too.
Mm.
Because this expansion symmetry, in the near boundary, it's, corresponds to the Newtonian limit.
Okay.
But inside is different.
Yes.
Then I cannot be sure that just because this expansion, this Newtonian limit, then I will have this integrity condition totally for Kerr.
Yeah. So in the context of the self force, geodesic motion around Kerr is integrable, and the we have the condition for the first and second order self forces to preserve integrability, which are what I said, the Fourier components of the perturbations to the Hamiltonian on the resonant orbits should vanish. And yes, I'm not sure how to answer more. Well, I guess what the question is explicitly.
If this condition is definitely for
Kerr or just for Newtonian? No, they're valid in Kerr, yes, in any space-time, I think. And you don't have to do any approximation on what the background is.
His approximation is not post-Newtonian. It's post-Kerr.
Yes, it's a small mass ratio, which is starts with a geodesic in Kerr, with all the non-linearities of Kerr, and then expanding a small mass ratio expansion. So it definitely works for Kerr or Schwarzschild or any black hole metric that you want. Yes.
All right, let's thank Francisco again. He'll be here for the rest.
Yes, if anyone wants to...